Good evening, everyone. This is T.C. Tompkins back at you again with another session of Music and Conversations. Let's do our disclaimer. I want you to know that the views stated on this show by myself or my guests are that of ourselves and not that of the station or its management. We appreciate you tuning in this week on Amazing 102.5 FM. I got a couple of subjects I want to cover before we get into anything. Okay. I had an artist call me a few weeks ago and told me that someone had told him that radio was antiquated, that was the old school way of developing music was through radio. I want you to let you know that any artist that's out there making any kind of real major money had a hit record on radio. Okay, it's just no way around it. Social media is wonderful if you're doing activity, you're involved in something that could pique the interest. If you're a music recording artist, your music is one of the driving forces of your social media activity and your participation in life. You can't do it just digitally, you know. So if you're not an attractive, sexy person or a young person, there's really not too much activity you're going to get from social media. And social media, I've not seemed to been able to find where it's really been a blessing or development factor in R&B music, especially grown and sexy music. It's just not a factor. It hasn't been a factor thus far with any of the R&B acts that I've been involved with. You know, so there's a place for it. I would think of it as being a part of a puzzle or a piece of a fragment of the total picture. But it is not a saving grace. Neither is the internet if you don't have an image or if you don't have any relevance. If there's no relevance with you, anyone's not aware of you before the invention of social media or the internet, I don't see how it's going to create any kind of new activity for you or do anything to enhance your career, you know. So along with radio, I think it's a great thing. I just don't feel like you should put your whole entire future of that in those hands. I also have a new project I want to sort of bring to everybody's attention this week, which is a suggestion of my management that we introduce new music, you know. Okay. Don't be sitting over there laughing. You know, I heard the Fantasia album, the new Fantasia album this week. I was very impressed with it. It seemed like she really is expanding as an artist. She's trying some new things in this new project that I really like. She's even got a country sounding track in there called Ugly, which is really hot. She's got a R&B Aretha Franklin kind of track in there called Sleeping with the One I Love, you know, which is a great track. Also, I was going to mention streaming to artists. Now, streaming is the major factor in the income of a lot of artists nowadays. But I want everybody to remember, over half the United States, or half the people in this country, don't even own many streaming services. And the ones that do own it are complaining. Just read an article the other day, they're just complaining about that monthly fee. You know, so I don't know how long that bubble is going to last as far as that being a real entity and as far as making capital. Right now, it is the main source of capital revenue for artists as far as their airplay is concerned. But let me tell you something, you're not going to get a streaming hit until it's a hit on major radio, you know. Streaming stations play what's popular, just like everybody else. And the gold standard for me, I think, and maybe I'm old school, is morning and afternoon drive on radio. You know, that's the gold standard. You know,
let me add to that. You know, people have to understand that people generally get up to the radio station.
Mm-hmm.
They go, you know, afternoon drive, they're in the car, so they're
captured audience.
Captured by the radio station. So, you know, basically, as far as the R&B audience is concerned, I've always learned that, and I've always lived by this, mm-hmm. is the fact that people live, they are entertained. You know, you use the radio for information, weather, sports,
and entertainment.
Uh-huh. Right. Mm-hmm. And then you get your information. What time? And the time.
Yeah.
What time? People set their lives by what's going on the radio at a certain time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the news comes on at 7:35. Okay, I better be out the door.
Well, you know, but I mean, another factor which I think is, and especially in our major markets like Boston, New York, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, Houston, Atlanta, those markets, man, if you work, you're in your car at least 2 to 3 hours a day.
Right, right.
You know?
And if you have a personal, local personality.
Absolutely.
You know, they dictate, you know, primarily what you say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hey, the color of the day is.
Yeah.
The word of the day.
Absolutely.
The phrase of the week or the phrase of the day.
So I wanted to really sort of bring that out that, you know, some people feel like radio is antiquated and radio is yesteryear. The last statistics, matter of fact, that I read this, 84% to 85% of all music sales are generated through radio, either satellite or streaming, which is really radio.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
AM, FM. And AM, FM has the largest majority of generated activity.
Exactly.
Okay.
Right.
And so if you don't have that activity, there is no booking of shows, you know. And I'm going to tell you this, and I've seen this, I've lived this. It may not be the least expensive, but it is the shortest route from A to B. A hit record on radio leads to TV, which leads to branding, which leads to movies,
right.
which leads to everything.
Everything, right.
Okay?
But it starts with that DJ.
Absolutely.
And promoting your product.
Absolutely. I just got a blast, matter of fact, from, I think it was EMI Records, which is the person over there who paid the bills now is Katy Perry.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Katy Perry, first week out of the box, 160 major pop stations.
Wow. Did that catapult her to number one?
I'm sure it did. I didn't really see the numbers, but I noticed that the promotional staff at EMI had put out that the record had hit 160 stations the first week. That's strong. I mean, that's strong as a lie.
That's crazy.
Yeah. You know, and any kind of major act that any kind of major label has any kind of real financial commitment in, and I'm sure they have a ton of financial commitments in Katy Perry, you know, her Twitter followers and Instagram followers and all of that are great. And she has millions of followers, which she uses to announce her music, which any artist who has a lot of major followers use to make the announcement to their music and all of that and make that type of intro. But you don't start there. The reason why they have all of these followers is that they've had major hits on radio.
Radio.
Yeah. You know, so that is a main point that I wanted to make to this artist that had asked me that he had felt like someone had told him that radio really didn't have any kind of bearing.
Wow.
What's happening, you know.
But that's not true.
No, that's not.
Radio is really here to stay.
Yeah, that's not true to say. Now, I'm sure eventually digital radio is going to have more and more influence on what happens. Internet radio is going to have more and more influence because technology is going to
change.
Yeah, it's going to change it. And it's going to be where you got your internet stations. Matter of fact, I was speaking on this other week that I had a system in this Forerunner that I just got rid of that had digital radio. It had high-def digital radio on it.
Right.
So I could pick up a lot of stations that I couldn't primarily pick up on just an average AM, FM radio tuner. But, you know, like I stated before, Chevrolet is going to be having
digital radio
in all their cars next year, I think, or this year one, you know.
But, you know, it reminds me back in the early 70s when AM radio was the dominant force.
Absolutely.
AM radio, then the late 70s, about 77, 78, then FM radio started coming into play. Mm-hmm. You know, you had WBLS, you know, which was the standard. You had WDAS in Philadelphia. And then the other station across the street came up.
Kiss?
No. Okay. But anyway, then you had KJLH was, you know, but, you know, FM radio started coming around, and people said, FM radio is not going to stay because AM radio was a dominant force, but you had that better sound quality and FM radio, and it just took
It killed it. I knew exactly when they first introduced FM radio. I knew that was the death of AM. It just wasn't stereo. Right. And matter of fact, AM tried AM stereo, I think, for a while. I don't know why they didn't.
Technology. It still had a flat
signal
sound.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, when I remember when WBLS and WDAS used to come on, you hear the separation of the speakers. WDAS. You know, all around.
That's a round sound.
I said, what the heck?
Yeah.
And so, you know, it became a standard. Then AM radio started going by the wayside. Mm-hmm. You know, but my point is this, is that technology is constantly changing.
Absolutely.
What's going to be next? You know, streaming possibly.
Yeah.
You know, and also interterrestrial radio, which is, you know, the Pandoras and the Sirius radio.
Sporty, all of that. Yeah.
People said that, you know, Sirius wouldn't work, but it's growing.
Yeah. Yeah. Sirius worked. Sirius.
Because it costs money to get it, but then again.
That's the only reason why it doesn't have as much of an impact as AM and FM, because AM, FM is free.
Right.
But Sirius, I think,
But TV used to be free, and now everybody's getting cable.
Oh, they pay for it.
They're paying for cable.
Yeah. But, you know, they were telling me, though, now a lot of services are starting to stream their services instead of putting it on through the other, you know, signals.
Right.
So you're
going to ABC, NBC,
yeah,
CBS,
all of them going to start streaming.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So you're going to be able to get anything, any kind of entertainment you want through streaming services.
So the Roku services and the
through your things there, you know. But hey, I want to take a break. You want to cue up one of Fantasia's new tracks here? We want to listen to one of her tracks, and then we're going to take a break here. This is called Roller Coaster.
Step right up, step right up, come on, come on. It's the ride of your life, is the rise and the fall. Ain't nothing to fear but the fear in your mind. So go ahead and get in line.
I tell you a story. One about a small town girl who got home with glory and felt like she could rule the world. But where was she that night when she was feeling all the pain until the sunrise? Today is just another day. I don't see how these ups and downs keep me on the ground. All these roller coasters in my mind roll by, lines around the block just for one ride. Round and round and round, like I'm sometimes say we've all been there before, trying to get on a ride we can't ignore. So now this is her life, got more than she had bargained for riding on her mind. It made her want it more and more. I don't see how these ups and downs.
Yeah. it up, take a ride on this roller coaster. If you want a nightmare or a daydream, either way I'll get you closer. You get to throw your hands up high, scream like you're supposed to. Damn. Try to keep your cool, ready to keep your composure. It's just the way life goes up and goes down. Head in the cloud with your feet on the ground. Wait in that water, boy, I hope you don't drown. Spinning around and around and around.
Tracks from my girl Fantasia. I really like this project. I think she's come a long way in the style. And it could be the producer. She's working with this new producer on this project, which has really made a difference in her sound and the music that she presents on this project. Okay. Have you listened to any of it?
I listened to Ugly, and I thought that was a very
country.
Strong cut. Right, good
yeah.
Country song.
Uh-huh.
And that was the first time I ever heard Roller Coaster, and I thought that was a very strong cut.
Mm-hmm.
We will be playing that.
Okay. I like that. Okay. Yeah, matter of fact, also my boy, since we want to bring up another topic here, we got another topic we can do here.
Oh, absolutely.
My boy, the guy that I'm interviewing this week is a good friend of mine named Ken Reynolds. He's a publicist in Los Angeles. I used to work with him when I was with CBS back at when he was dealing with Cheryl Lynn and Patti LaBelle. And he used to deal with one of our boys, Roy Ayers.
Oh, wow.
Used to work with Roy Ayers and a couple of other great guys. But he posted a video. And I had been thinking about this thought anyway. I made this statement on an interview I did a few months ago at a hip hop radio station, and I told him, I said, well, you know, I said, man, you may call me old school, old fashioned. I said, but you know, the black community was really doing better when they were segregated.
Yeah, you know? That's true.
You know, it's a newspaper that comes up out of Atlanta called Atlanta Black Star, and they put up a video that Ken had posted, which I shared on my page. And they put up a video on there, how integration has hurt the black community. Now, it's just like they were really reading my thoughts. But these are some of the statistics that they had posted on this video, is that the unemployment rate for blacks has skyrocketed since integration. Pregnancy rate has skyrocketed. Out of marriage pregnancy rate, during segregation it was 8%. Now it is 75%. you know, and also that, yeah, I said the income for black businesses, the separation of black families, I think the way they do it nowadays is a different type of segregation. They segregate by tax base.
Wow.
You know, I mean, that's really it. And I you know what, we all are a little guilty of this, including me and you, because, you know, as soon as you get something, you want to move. You move out
to
of
a better neighborhood.
Yeah,
to a better
neighborhood. Out of the black community.
Right.
As soon as anybody black makes any money, first thing they do
right.
is move out of the community.
We change.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we change. So, I mean, and so it destroys the tax base in the black community. So that's the reason why our schools are subpar. All our services are subpar, because they're saying that the tax base
right.
doesn't support putting any money in the community.
That's a whole show. That's
yeah.
a whole nother.
Okay. I mean, that's the new trick. As my man Parrish used to say, it's called trickerations.
That's a whole show, yeah. man. We could be on that for like 2 hours.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but that is the new discrimination. It's just no equal sharing of revenue in the city.
No, because you notice, we had a home in Third Ward for the longest.
Uh-huh.
And the tax rate was low. Now, because it's in the inner city.
I used to love that house, too. Yeah.
Not because it's in, and the tax rates are going up, and a lot of blacks are being forced to move out.
Yeah.
You know, because it's close to the medical center. It's close to, Third Ward's close to the medical center, downtown.
Absolutely.
All the freeways and the convenience.
Yeah.
You know, all the great restaurants. So blacks are having to move out.
Nobody wants to make that commute.
Nobody wants to make that commute.
So I know.
The medical
yeah.
center, the doctors and the nurses and medical students, they're
so that house, that house that you had, they put two condos up on that lot.
They put eight condos, right,
on that lot that you had.
On that lot,
and they getting what, about $500,000 per condo?
At the time, they're getting like $300
uh-huh.
per condo.
Well, I know the housing market is suffering now because of oil in Houston. But,
right, but it's yeah. it's going to come
oh,
back.
You know? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Just let it be a bad winter up north. Or,
oh, yeah.
Or,
oh, no. We're going to get oil going to go back up. Ain't no question about
it's
that.
It's coming back.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but that is the new discrimination. It's the tax base.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And I used to feel, you know, even though when I was a youngster and a kid and I was going in school, you know, I was raised in East Texas, which is, you know, I guess just as racist. As a matter of fact, they said Texas has more hate groups than any state in the
yeah.
country. I'm not really surprised.
That's another conversation.
Yeah. I'm not really surprised about that. But, you know, when I was going to school and when me and my wife were going to school, hey, baby, we were given books and stuff that were supposed to have been stopped using back in the 40s and 50s.
Right.
I remember seeing that when I was a kid. I'd look inside the book cover and see the date that the expiration of this book is out of date after such and such a date. The book would have been 10 years out of date.
Right.
Okay.
Right. We get secondhand.
Yeah.
Right. Because hand-me-downs.
Hand-me-down books that they were giving us.
Social educational hand-me-downs.
Absolutely. So you know the education. My education, even though I think I'm fairly intelligent.
Right.
You know, but it had to be a lot of things that I did on my own and my world experience that made me this way, because it damn sure wasn't from the education I received. In Atlanta, Texas, which I grew up in. That's the length of the interview? Cool. Okay. So let's get another track in from Fantasia. Okay. I really like this album. What track are we gonna be playing now?
Ugly.
Ugly. Yeah, this is a real different type of track for Fantasia. I really like this. Okay. Hit it.
Got 100 pounds soaking wet. All stressed out and worried. Poured down my Siri. And I don't know how or why when her daddy left, but he drove off in a fury. She grew up in a hurry. Now skinny jeans and Maybelline make pretty girls do crazy things. Can they just me. It's all so ugly. Picket fence to car garage. Demand that she don't love, but he makes six figures. She thought he'd fix her. That iron gate feels more and more like an old birdcage than a way to keep her out of danger. So she takes to liquor. And all the champagne brushes and upper class shine can't keep a woman satisfied. Trimming fools and bows and braids, and the baby thinks her mom's a living maid. If you ask me, it's all so ugly. So give me rusty old ringside old. Give me good food that sticks to my bones. Thank you for that good, good man who loves me. With dirt on my hands, it's scrapes on my knees. Feeling that night when I wash it all clean. Ugly. 18 wheels and an open road. I sing my songs all across the country. 'Cause these people trust me.
Hey, TC.
Hey, man. How you doing?
I'm okay.
Tell, and I know you from the time that I worked in New York. You are really, are you a native New Yorker, Ken?
I am not. I'm from Chicago.
From Chicago. That's right. That's
I was
right.
Born and raised in Chicago.
You know, but now, were you living in New York at the time that we met, or were you, did you stay in New York?
No, we were living, I was living in New York. I moved to New York. When I was 18, because I wanted to be a disc jockey.
Mm-hmm.
And I had gone to broadcasting school in New York, and a couple of friends that I had gone to school with convinced me that I should move to New York, because I went, when I finished school, which was in New York, I went home to Chicago,
uh-huh.
and I made my tapes, and I sent them out to all the secondary and tertiary markets like they suggested,
right.
Trying to get a job, and of course I got that proverbial letter. You know, call us when you get some experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, how the hell am I going to ever get any experience if everybody keeps telling me this?
Yeah.
And a friend convinced me to move to New York.
Uh-huh.
And I did. But on my first day in New York, I got sidetracked. I got a job working for a TV show, The Merv Griffin Show.
I mean, and thank God.
Yeah, thank God.
You know what I mean? Yeah. I mean, man, I don't see how New York would have been the market to move to. If you're trying to break into radio, man, that's a
tough. Well, come on. I was 19 years old. Did I know any better?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I'm going to say I had $50 in my pocket,
man,
and $1 million worth of dreams.
Yeah.
And it didn't seem impossible to me.
You had the heart to try. You know what, though, kid? That's the first thing that a lot of people are liking. It's just a hard to try, man. You know, you're going to step up to the plate. With $50, dog, you had to be bold.
Well, you call it bold. When I look back, I think, God, that was kind of stupid. But
that was bold.
But at 19, it's like, you know, there's no end to the world for you. You
absolutely.
I was always one of those people that I knew that I would find a job doing something. I could do a lot of different things at 19. I could type. I could take shorthand. I had worked at Walgreens. I had delivered chicken. I had worked at the post office. I had worked at the bank at night while I was in college. I had done a number of things, and I was confident that I will find a job to be able to support myself, one, because that's the way I was brought up, and that is that you always have to take care of yourself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, but
with that in mind, I packed up and went.
So you tell us, so you landed this job with Merv Griffin then, right? With the Merv Griffin
show. I did. I was a page where I used to answer fan mail, send out tickets to people who were going to be in New York 9 months later and wanted tickets to the show, run errands, go get lunch for the producers and the directors, all of that kind of gopher work. And then one day, one of the producers called down to the box office, because that's where all the pages worked. There were like 8 or 9 of us. I, of course, was the only black one there.
Of course.
A secretary, the producer's secretary, called down to the box office and wanted to know if there was a page that knew how to type. I was the only one that knew how to type. And they were behind on some paperwork up in the producer's office. And they called me upstairs to do this work, and I typed 90 words a minute, which was pretty remarkable at the time.
Yeah, you were smoking. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I was smoking on that machine. This was on an old IBM typewriter, okay? And they liked me. They liked my personality. I also knew shorthand, too.
Okay.
I knew two kinds of shorthand, which was, you know, people used back in the day. And they started using me more and more, and when their bosses weren't around, they would take 2 and 3 hour lunches and have me cover the phones, and I was able to take an intelligent message, and they just, you know, they gave me more opportunity after opportunity. And one day Merv's secretary was sick, and he had a temp, and he told the temp to get him William Morris on the telephone. And she came back and told him that, oh, Mr. Griffin, I'm sorry, William Morris has been dead for many years. So she was fired on the spot.
Oh, yeah. Lord have mercy. William Morris agency, you fool. Yeah,
exactly. So she knew nothing about the business. She knew absolutely nothing. Clearly, she knew nothing about the business.
Oh, my God.
And they told me that, can you have to go and work with Merv today? And of course I had seen him around the building, and I hadn't even met him, but it was a little challenging for me. It's like, oh no, I can't do that. And it's like, yeah, no, you have to. He doesn't want to temp. Somebody's got to go and do it. You're qualified. You have to go and do it. And very nervously, I went upstairs to the penthouse where his office was, and I filled in for his secretary. Well, she was ill a lot.
Okay.
And it got to the point that he only wanted me when she was out. And we bonded, and you know, we had a great working relationship. And then, of course, Merv moved to California with the whole show, and the company that produced it, Westinghouse Broadcasting Company, brought in the David Frost Show, and I remained with the David Frost Show. And then I got to book talent. It was interesting. I was on Facebook yesterday, and I saw some posts from Valerie Simpson and her first album, Exposed. And I wrote a comment because the Valerie Simpson was the first artist that I interviewed. I wanted, at this, by this time, I wanted to be a talent coordinator. I wanted to book talent on the show.
Okay.
And I kept looking for my way in. And Valerie Simpson had a new album. They did not know who Valerie Simpson and Nick Ashford were. I went to the producer, and I pitched this idea to them, and they bought it. And they let me do the interview. You would do a pre-interview before the guest came on the show.
Right.
Where one of the talent coordinators sits and talks with the potential guest, finds out what they want to talk about, how their host segment is going to run, come and present it, and give it to the host. In this case, it was David Frost. And Valerie turned out to be a really great guest. My notes on her were very good. And that began a roll. I think the next artist interviewed was Ravi Shankar.
Okay.
And I don't know if you remember Ravi Shankar. He was the sitar player who taught George Harrison from the Beatles how to play the sitar. And then it was on the road. Then I did some. I got to do some of my personal favorites. I'll never forget my interview with Aretha Franklin. Of course, the Supremes, the Four Tops, Smokey Robinson, and then I did some legendary people like Sophia Loren, Paul Newman, and Diane Carroll.
Oh my God! Yeah.
And then I jumped up and moved to Europe.
Well, you know what, Ken? I mean, all of that started, and I wanted all of that started there when the opportunity presented itself. You were the only one that had the qualifications and that had prepared themselves for success. You know, I mean, you had all those skills behind you. You had all that skill set. So when the door for opportunity opened, you jumped right in. So when you went to Europe, what were you doing in Europe?
I went to do absolutely nothing.
Okay.
Just to experience it.
Mm-hmm.
But I got wrangled into, I the first thing I did was enroll in a class to learn to speak Spanish. And while I was doing that, someone convinced me that I should teach English. And of course, I needed money because I had enough money what I thought was going to last me for the time I was there.
Mm-hmm.
I had saved. I didn't totally. It wasn't like my move to New York. This time I planned it a little better.
Okay.
But I got this opportunity to teach with the University of Barcelona to teach English. All the young guys in Barcelona would love to go to the Nordic countries, so go to Scandinavia, go to Copenhagen, go to Norway, go to Sweden, to work at all the resorts for the summer. But they had to know English in order to do this.
Mm.
So all these young Spanish guys wanted to learn English so that they could go away for the summer to earn money to come back and go to school. So there was a need for English teachers. And I fell right into that, and I started teaching English. And it was most of my students were all these guys, and their goal was to get to Scandinavia for the summer to work at the resorts.
Uh-huh.
And I stayed in Europe for 9 months. Came back to I came home to Chicago for a couple of months and moved back to New York. And met a guy named Ellis Hayslip who produced a TV show called Soul. It was on our public broadcast TV at the time. It was somewhat of a black Ed Sullivan show. And Stevie Wonder was on the show, Minister Farrakhan, Roberta Flack, Ashford and Simpson, LaBelle, Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. In fact, Teddy Prendergast was the drummer with Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes at this time. And I did a lot of interesting things with them. One of the things we did was an event called Soul at the Center, which was 2 weeks of the black experience at Lincoln Center, utilizing every venue at the entertainment complex.
Oh,
and again,
great.
We had Ike and Tina Turner one Sunday, Jerry Butler one night, dance companies, the George Faison Universal Dance Company, the Spinners, Margie Josephs, a theater one night, The Hand is on the Gate. And Patty had just had a baby. So Sarah and Nona, two members of LaBelle, came to host one of the evenings. And I met them. And we got along famously for the evening, and it just so happened that they were looking for a stage manager. A few days after they hosted the event, I got a phone call from this English woman telling me that Sarah and Nona had met me, and they were looking for a stage manager. They were only working on the weekends at the time. This was before Lady Marmalade.
Okay.
And would I be interested in working as a stage manager on the weekend? Which I said, sure, I would love to. But I kept my job during the week, and on the weekends, I went on the road with LaBelle. We never went much further than, I think we, as far as we went was Boston to the north and D.C. to the south, and we only worked that whole area, colleges, universities, small clubs. We never came west. I mean, we didn't even go as far as Chicago or Detroit. They were very concentrated in that area. That's when they were looking for a new image. Of course, they signed with CBS Records. And at that point, they asked me to become their road manager. We went to New Orleans. They recorded Lady Marmalade. And, of course, that whole
that
thing
broke
became,
them.
That gave them international fame. And we toured the U.S. several times. We toured Europe a couple of times. That was that period.
How long did you work with LaBelle, man?
I worked with them from the time they recorded Lady Marmalade until they broke up.
Okay.
And that was a little over 4 years.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, because I met Sarah and them right after they had grown
You didn't meet them when they were a group?
No, I didn't meet them when they were a group. I met them after. I met Patty and Sarah and them after they had, you know.
When they were individually signed to the
absolutely
label.
Absolutely, they were individually signed. Now tell me about you working with one of my favorite artists, Roy Ayers, down here. that was my man back in the day. Roy Ayers was real live.
Roy was a great artist to work with. Roy, after I came back from Europe a second time, mm-hmm, because I went to Europe with Nona Hendrix and Peter Gabriel on a tour. And when I came back, I went to, I called a friend of mine who had somewhat been a mentor to mine. She was a publicist for Broadway. And mm-hmm, I mentioned, I think, that she was the only black publicist in the Broadway Publicist Union. And I called her and told her I was looking for a job, and she told me that this company was looking for a black publicist. And I told her, well, you know, I've never been a publicist. What does a publicist do? And she said, well, you're black, so you have half the qualifications. Call him.
Okay.
So I called him. But before I went to see him, I did call another publicist friend of mine, and she took me to lunch, and in an hour and a half taught me what a publicist does, taught me the right words to use during the interview, things to say during the interview. And I have a great memory, so I remembered everything she told me, and I went to this interview, and I used all the words that she told me to use, like pitch and angle and long lead time, and I got the job.
Okay, so you had to turn.
So then, now that I got the job, I had to go and learn how.
Okay.
I had to learn how to do the job. But the interesting thing about that job was, having been road manager for LaBelle, having been road manager for Nona and Peter Gabriel, having been out with a punk band called Television,
mm-hmm,
as road manager, I had to accompany them on all their interviews. So I knew so many journalists around the world already, and I knew them one-on-one. So when I got this job doing publicity, it's like, oh, wow, I know the guy from the New York Times. I know, mm-hmm, the guy from the Chicago Sun-Times. I know the guy from the L.A. Times. I know the people from Rolling Stone. I know the people from Jet. I know the people from Right On and Soul. I knew so many journalists already that it was kind of a natural evolution for this job. I worked there for a while. Then, of course, I came
like
to CBS.
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry. Then
like
I went to Polydor.
So once you got
went to Polydor and had a great group of artists, and that's where I met Roy at Polydor.
Okay. So once you got started into the publishers, I mean, you really took off with that. Then you met Roy. How long did you work with Roy?
I worked with Roy for almost 4 years because Roy remained at the label. When I first went to the label, it was Polydor.
Mm-hmm.
And Polydor, of course, was owned by PolyGram, which also owned Mercury and Casablanca. When the crunch in the industry came, PolyGram consolidated the labels and took Mercury, Casablanca, and Polydor and made them one label, PolyGram. Roy remained on the label. I remained with the company, so my relationship continued with Roy. So I worked with Roy the entire time I was at Polydor through PolyGram. Again, 4 years seems to be a magical number.
Uh-huh.
It was about 4 years. Before I left PolyGram, Arista had signed a brand new artist, and they were looking for a black head of product management, and
okay,
they wanted someone to develop this new artist. And my old friend Jerry Griffith had recommended me for the job. I went and I met with Clive Davis, and I met with the head of artist development, and they offered me a job. And the new artist turned out to be Whitney Houston. I wrote the initial marketing plan for Whitney's debut album. I took her out on her very first promotional tour. I also got to work with some other great artists, too. Aretha and Kenny G and Jeff Lorber and Jermaine Jackson Houdini.
Mm. Well, now on that Whitney Houston situation, Jerry was really behind the signing of Whitney, wasn't he?
Jerry is the one who, you know, I know there are all kinds of stories around, But Jerry is the person who actually found Whitney.
Oh, I know he was. Yeah, I know.
Oh, I know you was. Know. Yeah, yeah, I know. I think so many people outside of the industry don't know that.
Absolutely. I know my boy Clyde takes the bows, but I know it was Jerry that found Whitney Houston. And same thing with Luther Vandross, our boy Jerome Gasper.
Jerome Gasper.
Yeah. Found
well, you know, just it's always the subservient person who does the work, and the head
absolutely.
Of the company takes the credit.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Now, matter of fact, I was thinking about another artist that you worked with a long time that a partner of mine was just laughing about. I think you told me last time we spoke that she was in Japan appearing, and we're talking about Cheryl Lynn. She's been working off It's Got to Be Real for 30 years.
I mean, and that just goes to show you the strength of a hit record. And if you're smart enough to write it and own the publishing,
ooh,
how you can have a lifetime
from
one hit record like that.
Mm-hmm.
That record has been in movies. It has been in animations. It has been on TV. It has been in commercials. And you don't hear it without her getting a dime for it.
No,
you know, she gets paid every time that record is played.
You know, it's like that first record that Luther did,
Never Too Much.
Never Too Much. That track, man, I hear it almost every new project. Yeah, that one and them Toomey Juicy Fruit, those are about the most used tracks I can think of other than, you know, probably George Clinton and James Brown.
Right, and those guys all wrote those things, thank God.
Absolutely. Well, I said, how long did you work with Cheryl? Were you with Cheryl during the time she was at CBS when she had got
I was, I was. In fact, interesting thing, you know how departmentalized CBS was? There was a black publicity department and a white publicity department.
Mm-hmm.
When I came to CBS Records, I came from a PR company where there were no divisional lines like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had white acts, I had black acts, I had country acts, I had all kinds of acts. So it took me a moment when I got to CBS to fall into the pattern that, okay, I am head of black publicity now,
mm-hmm.
and I'm only supposed to talk to the black writers.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Like I said, my experience, I knew so many writers. And when I got there, I'll never forget Bill Carlton, who was the music editor at the New York Daily News, called me up and congratulated me. And he said to me, so what's happening over there? So I said, well, this is new artist, Cheryl Lynn, that, you know, this album is great. Everybody's raving about it. He says, oh, I don't have it. Send it to me. I sent it to him.
Mm-hmm.
He loved it. He wrote a huge full-page story on Cheryl Lynn, which was great. And this is like the week the record came out.
Oh, man.
Which I thought was a wonderful, great thing.
Oh, yeah, it was. Absolutely.
Well, I got called in on the carpet for it.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Because who gave him this record? Where did he get this record from?
Yeah.
Oh, no, you are only supposed to talk to the black writers.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, instead of, hey, this is wonderful, congratulations.
Oh, I know. Now, don't do that no more. Yeah.
Well, I didn't while I was there. Until one day, it's funny because you said you're going to talk to Susan Blount.
Mm-hmm.
One day at one of those marketing meetings, I think you might remember how the meeting was also divided up. The room, they would go around the room and the pop side would give their report even on the black artists.
Mm-hmm.
And then the R&B side would give their report on the R&B artists. So you get two reports on one artist, one from the white publicist and one from the black publicist.
That's true.
Well, at one of the Epic meetings, Susan Blount, when it got time for the pop publicist report, Susan stood up and she said that, in case everybody doesn't know, we have Kent Reynolds in the, whatever we were called, the Black Music Marketing Division. That's what
mm-hmm.
it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes to us with a lot of experience. He's worked with Melanie, the old folk singer, Horse Lips, an Irish rock and roll band, Foghat, Al Green.
Mm.
And I remember Tony Martell and Jack, I can't remember Jack's last name, but they used to head the meeting. And looking at her with this very impatient look, okay, so what do you talk, what's your point? And she then went on to, she proceeded to say that I came with so much experience that there would no longer be a division in the report, that I would give the entire report for the R&B artists.
Mm.
And at that point, it changed. And I think I was the first publicist that made that crossover, I guess, then now it was okay for a black publicist to call the New York Times and the Daily News and the New York Post and Rolling Stone and not just be relegated to Jet and Ebony and Soul magazine.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I mean, it was definitely segregated. I mean, you know, I cannot argue with you on that. I mean, most of my arguments that I had while I was at Epic Records was because of that, you know, and because of the representation. Because, you know, as soon as the artists got successful, they weren't R&B artists anymore. They became
pop artists. Yeah, I know. And it wasn't just at Epic. It was at Polly Graham and at Arista as well.
Absolutely. As soon as they started making some money, they became pop artists. They weren't black artists anymore. Ken, tell us about your work with the Thurgood Marshall Scholarship Fund, too. Because I definitely want to mention all the things that you've done to give back.
Well, of course, the Thurgood Marshall Scholarship Fund is a not-for-profit organization that provides scholarship monies for African-American students to go to HBCU colleges and universities across the country.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, it's not-for-profit, so they are dependent upon of the country's support.
Absolutely.
They have a big dinner, or at this point they did have a big dinner every year when Dwayne Ashley was the president of the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And I would coordinate their annual dinner and bring them a host for the dinner. And we did some wonderful work with Jack Kay and Shirley Ralph, Lynn Whitfield, Angela Bassett, and of course my personal favorite, Diane Carroll, who actually hosted twice.
Okay. Now I'm looking here at your bio, and matter of fact, did you ever work with Logan Westbrook? Because I see Charles Wright in 103rd Street Band. Did you work with Logan?
Yeah, Charles became a client of mine when during my independent. You know, since I've been in L.A. and I, you know, put out my single doing independent work, that's when I met Charles and we did some wonderful work together. I guess it was maybe 2 years ago when his song was placed in on the soundtrack of 50 Shades of Grey, the movie.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, so Charles is a new association. I've only known Charles like 5 years.
Now you're working in Los Angeles now with artists and representing artists out there on the West Coast as publicists?
Well, when I first moved out here, the whole climate in the music industry had changed, and they weren't spending independent dollars on the acts that I was comfortable with working with and those that I knew how to work with best.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was hip-hop and rap, and that was I didn't progress with that scene, so that was a little different for me. But once again, I was lucky enough to fall into a category of working with some of the black actors. I was able to do some work with my dear friend Anna Maria Horsford and Jack Kay, Samuel Jackson, Angela Bassett, Thelma Hopkins, the people from Family Matters, Darius McQuarrie, Robert Townsend and his show The Parenthood, a few TV shows.
Okay.
And that was the time when a lot of black people were working, or that group of black people were working on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And lately, somehow I got known for being a celebrity wrangler. Which is people call me when they need celebrities. People will call me, they need 5 celebrities at this event in Morocco. They need 5 celebrities at this event in New York or in Atlanta or whatever. And that has taken a life of its own. And I do a lot of celebrity wrangling right now. I also fell into working with this historic club, Maverick's Flats. Maverick opened up 50 years ago in 1966.
Mm-hmm.
And it was premier black club here in Los Angeles. Kool and the Gang, Gap Band, Earth, Wind & Fire, Chaka Khan, Richard Pryor. All of those people played this club 60s, 70s, 80s, even up to the early 90s. The club kind of fell dormant, And now they are trying to rebrand it and revitalize it and bring it back to life. And I've been booking some acts there. I brought Allison Williams there. Allison was once the first lady of Def Jam. Mm-hmm. I'm about to, I think Melissa Morgan is coming next month. Of course, we had a spectacular, amazing night with Eddie LaVert from the OJs. Thanks to Belinda Wilson and Eddie Sims, you remember them, of course.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You could forget Eddie. Eddie, as a matter of fact, Eddie and I were counterparts at one point. Eddie was handling Columbia, I think it was, and I was handling Epic. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you guys were down the hall from me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
On the seventh floor.
Yeah.
Down the hall and around the bend.
Oh, my God. Yes, man. We moved up on the 13th. We moved up. So, Ken, so now how can anybody reach you if they're looking for publishers? Are you doing open for new publishers?
Oh, I most certainly am. I definitely am. I can be reached. The best way to reach me is at Public Relations Plus, and that's PLUS, @gmail.com. I'm on Facebook at Kenneth R. Reynolds. R is important because there's a lot of Kenneth Reynolds, but mm-hmm. there's only one Kenneth R. Reynolds.
Okay. And I tell anybody listening to us, I recommend you highly. You are you're excellent at what you do. You enjoy it, you know, and which makes it a lot easier. I know that you know, if you're not getting any pleasure out of what you're doing, boy, at this point, man, it makes you old.
Oh, no, absolutely. You know, I absolutely love what I'm doing. And, uh-huh. you know, this is airing in Houston, right?
Absolutely.
Because there's an artist who lives in Houston, Mary Griffin.
Oh, yeah.
Who I also worked with at one time when she was signed to Curb Records. So let me shout out to Mary Griffin.
Absolutely. Mary's a great vocalist, man. I've seen Mary perform.
Oh, that woman is so incredibly talented.
Yes,
it's like
she is.
Just beyond belief.
Yeah, well, I saw her perform, I think, one night at the Red Cat when it was open here downtown. But she's a monster. She's a great artist. Matter of fact, I think I'm going to try to call Mary and have her on the show. But I will definitely tell her that you said hello. And, hey, man, I appreciate you doing this for the second time because I want everybody to know that we did this interview earlier. And I didn't record it, but I guarantee I got you this time, Ken. And I thank you so much, man.
Let me know when it airs so I can let my four or five friends in Houston know.
Oh, it will probably air this Sunday. Okay.
This Sunday at what time?
This Sunday at 3:00. Okay. On KMAZ. Amazing.
KMAZ, okay.
Amazing 102.5. Okay.
All right. 102.5 Sunday at 3:00.
Take care, man. God bless.
All right. Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.